as they make this bold move for workers' power, a movement that can change the face of the future for all of us. So far, $2,500 has been raised. Be a part of this historic effort and add your contribution today. Don't wait. Go to uhurunews.com today and show your support for the growing organized African resistance sweeping the continent and around the world. Up next on Africa Live, we bring you a rebroadcast of an interview that Inya Binga de Zimbabwe did with Efia in Mwangaza about her work with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's Atlanta Project that formulated the Black Power demand of the 1960s in the U.S. Uhuru.
Uhuru, and welcome to Reparations in Action, the online radio show of the African People's Solidarity Committee here on uhururadio.com. The African People's Solidarity Committee is the organization made up predominantly of white people working under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, USA. We organize in the white communities, winning others just like ourselves to recognize our interest in standing in solidarity with the struggle for liberation of Africa and African people everywhere. As always, we thank Uhuru Radio and Uhuru News Network for allowing us to have this show every week. With me today is Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee, and we're here to be summing up the deeper meaning of Christmas. Uhuru, Penny.
Uhuru Harris, and welcome to everybody who's tuned in to Reparations in Action today.
And, you know, we're just in the middle of this holiday season, which is always just such an incredibly imperialist time in the United States and Europe and around the world, really. And we just finished the Thanksgiving holiday a few weeks ago, which, of course, we know is the holiday that celebrates the genocide of the indigenous people and the theft of their land right here.
Yes. I mean, an estimated 300 million indigenous people were wiped out in this hemisphere so that white people could occupy this land. And once a year, we have this thank you holiday, which we celebrate by eating ourselves till we burst. And I mean, it's, you know, it's really, really outrageous when we think about the fact that indigenous people are living in concentration camps called reservations now, with the lowest life expectancy of any group inside the borders of the United States, and in deep poverty. This, you know, reality is still here. And it is just, when we think about the true meaning of the, you know, of Thanksgiving.
Right.
And I think that the indigenous people who have survived this genocide against them have done a tremendous amount to raise and expose the truth about this holiday, which also follows on the heels of Columbus Day, mm-hmm. and which is clearly the celebration of the perpetrator of the beginning of the genocide against indigenous people by as part of the whole European assault on what we call the Americas. But, you know, and I think that there are people who know something about the truth about Thanksgiving. But do people know about the origin of the celebration of Christmas, which has little, if anything, to do with the birth of somebody known as Jesus Christ in Bethlehem in what is now known as Israel? Chairman O'Malley Shetela has made over the years a lot of presentations about Christmas and summing it up as a symbol for parasitic capitalism that is, you know, tons of gifts and products and commodities and all kinds of things and toys for white children and, of course, for white adults as well, made by these elves somewhere in the North Pole who, you know, work to make this stuff. And we don't really see how it's made. But it's kind of like, you know, the good children are rewarded. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about is loot and prosperity and wealth that comes at the expense of African and indigenous peoples around the world, you know? So this is part of the history of Christmas as a capitalist holiday, which has certainly been evolved, you know, in that way over the years. First of all, there was no proof that Jesus was born on December 25th. And in fact, all ancient religions, traditional religions, had the traditional solstice holiday, which would be somewhere between December 21st and December 25th. And that's, you know, that's been a reality since ancient times. So when the Catholic Church adopted and consolidated the Catholic religion as they saw it into an institution that was tied to state power in Europe, consolidated the Catholic Church. They consolidated the feast of Jesus Christ in the 4th century as an attempt to win Romans and what they called people who did not believe in Christ, to win them into the church based on keeping the holidays that they had celebrated for many, many years, you know, since ancient times. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it had been a Roman holiday in which for a week, something like December 18th to the 25th, all the courts were closed. There was no law whatsoever. You could do anything you wanted for a week.
Wow.
I mean, you know, and you wouldn't be arrested. You could kill people. You could rob them. You know, whatever you wanted to do. So, and that's sort of the way it is now. If you think about capitalism and what it's about in terms of plunder and, mm-hmm. and you know, taking the resources of oppressed peoples inside this country and around the world and making it, you know, into fabulous loot and resources for the general white population.
That's right, yeah.
But in the 19th century, Christmas was transformed into a more profitable holiday and a way to give a human face to capitalism. Chairman O'Malley Shetela points this out quite a bit. And he talks about how the Dickens piece, the short story, Christmas Carol, shows Scrooge, who is this Ebenezer Scrooge, who's this mad, nasty, kind of mean boss. And he gets hounded one night during the Christmas season by three different ghosts who show him Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future. And somehow this transforms him from a miser and an impressive boss into a kind, the kinder, gentler face of capitalism, and he takes a goose or a turkey to Tiny Tim and his family's house for Christmas. They're very impoverished. And, you know, we see that capitalism can work, and it can have a generous kind of face to it. And this was a whole kind of popular movement among capitalists in the 19th century to begin to transform capitalism so that they could keep the workers. Because only a few years prior to that, in the mid-19th century, there were the rebellions of workers all over Europe against capitalism, because the conditions that they were facing were very brutal. And of course, at that time, but the reality was that even those jobs on the part of workers in Europe came because of the stolen labor and stolen natural resources in Africa, Asia, and Latin America.
That's right.
So, you know, it's been an ongoing process.
Yeah, and it's typical style. Capitalism really feeds itself by promoting the spending of money back into the system, and it's promoted itself, you know, through Christmas and starting with Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of the year, the day after Thanksgiving. It's something like people spent $56 billion this year on stuff, you know, and these are the resources. These are the stolen loot, and it's being bought into by the general population here, and shows us that all holidays are about capitalism and about spending money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, $56 billion, and people were waiting in line at midnight to get in and get trampled in these stores, and people were fighting over getting the best deals, and you don't even know if those are the best deals. We're just told that if you stand in line at midnight and go into Walmart or Best Buy, you're going to get the best deal of the year. But it's, you know, they're saying that's not even true. What's happening is voluntary tax onto working people inside the U.S. to make up the huge shortfall that retailers have had. And it's responsible for something like 2/3 of their annual resources or income that they're getting. So, you know, it's just a ploy. And they call it Black Friday. And of course, I mean, that's appropriate because the wealth of the U.S. comes at the expense of African people. But it's also maybe called Black Friday because the stores are in the red all year round until they get to November, whatever that date is in November. And that's how they go into black ink. You know, they start to make some money based on that. So it's about capitalism. It's about spending money. I mean, it's just like every holiday in this country is about that. But in particular, there's, you know, the whole situation in Holland, and we want to talk about that a little bit. And it's something that Chairman O'Malley Shatella has talked about quite a bit. He was there during the celebration one year, I think he was in Amsterdam, the celebration of, they call him Sinterklaas, which is their word for Santa Claus. And Sinterklaas brings presents for good boys and girls. And his quote or sidekick is Schwarze Piet, of whom there are many. And Schwarze Piet is an African. He's supposed to be dressed as a Moor, which is the African who lived in Spain, Africans who lived in Spain in the Middle Ages. And but it's not even Africans who play the part. It's white people who put blackface on and dress up as Moors for these celebrations. So it's really offensive, and it's, you know, it's really outrageous. And Africans in Holland, of course, are extremely just outraged and offended by this tradition that white people love. And there's a struggle. There's a struggle going on against it. And this is really clear, you know, and this is, we're going to play a clip a little bit later of an interview by the chairman of a woman in Holland, an African woman in Holland, who's talking about this movement and this drive to get rid of the Zwarte Piet. But it's, you know, it's an interesting thing because the history of it is that in the 1500s, parts of Holland were ruled by Spain, which at that time controlled the world people. The Dutch fought off Spain and in the 1600s became wealthy through then their own trade in African people. They took over the slave trade. They took over the trade, the sale of African people, going into Africa, kidnapping Africans through the barrel of the gun, and selling them as a commodity. In fact, the first stock market began in Holland in the Amsterdam stock market in something like 1650. So, you know, and this is the era that is known throughout Europe as the Golden Age of Holland. It's when the great painters, quote unquote, were active, like Vermeer and Van Dyck and Rembrandt and, you know, all of this kind of thing, that there's tons of museums full of the paintings of these artists in Holland. But the reality is that the wealth that flowed into Holland at that time came only through the trade in African people and turning Africans into a commodity. And in the colonial holdings, the occupation colonially by the Netherlands of Java in Asia, of Ghana in South America, and many other places in the Caribbean and other places throughout the world. And this is what made Holland wealthy at that time. So, you know, it's just really important to point that out, because a lot of Americans, North Americans, go to Holland and they go to the museums and they see these painters, and, you know, there's nothing that puts it into context of where this, you know, they talk about the beautiful, what they call Delft blue. Delft is a town in Holland, and Vermeer and Rembrandt used this beautiful blues. But where this blue came from, it was the indigo pigment in Africa that was part of the assault on Africa. So all of this indigo was coming back into Holland, and the painters were using it to develop their art. So it shows how everything that we take for granted in the U.S. and in European society come at the expense of Africans. Mm-hmm. So in the year 1492, Moors, who are Africans, were in Spain. And actually, Moors, Africans, and Islamic and Arab people came to Spain in the year 700 AD. And they had an incredible civilization there. They were responsible during the Middle Ages for whatever understandings of science, of art, of technology, of excuse me, building, construction, architecture that existed in Europe during what was called the Dark Ages. It wasn't, you know, when they call it the Dark Ages, they're talking about how there was very little learning, very little understandings. Europe was very isolated, very oppressed, very impoverished, and basically had just very little civilization whatsoever. But the key to what civilization was there was the Moors, was the Muslim people, the Muslim civilization that was in Spain. And it basically covered all of Spain and Portugal until the white population of Spain began to organize and drive them out and push them further and further south, so that by the 1400s, the Moorish civilization, basically in Granada, Spain, which is a section of Spain that's basically in the southern part that borders the Mediterranean. But I mean, I've never been to Spain, and I would like to go. I would like to see it because there are beautiful, beautiful castles, palaces like the Alhambra Palace in Andalusia, Spain. There are universities that were created, you know, 1,000 years ago, and just all kinds of mosques and castles and ruins and some not in ruins, you know, some kinds of architecture that still exists there from the Africans who were there. But in the year 1492, which is the same year that Columbus came to Queen Isabella of Castile, later became Isabella of Spain, but at that time it was not consolidated, and asked her to fund his journey to the Americas. He didn't know it was the Americas. He thought he was going to India and China. And she did, and she had to hawk her jewels. She had to take them to a pawn shop in order to do that. And people say, well, it was a voyage of discovery to find out what the world was like. No, that is not true at all. Columbus went on the first voyage with three ships. When he landed in what is now Haiti and other islands in the Caribbean, he found indigenous people there and instantly began subjecting them and even committing genocide against them. And within 40 or 50 years, almost all of the indigenous people were wiped out of the Caribbean. But he was clear that the Caribbean islands could provide many, many resources that would be needed in Spain. And so his second journey, which was a couple of years later, he didn't go back with three ships, the Nina, the Santa Maria, and the Pinta. He went back with 17 ships and basically an army to take over what he found and to lay claim to that land, clearly as colonizers. So they were very clear about what they were doing. But the important thing also that we have to look at is the fact that 1492 was also the year that under Queen Isabella, Spain began to be consolidated as a white nation. So it was very clear it was sending Columbus out to conquer oppressed people, what became oppressed people. It launched the Inquisition, hideous plan of torture, absolute, you know, horrible torture against Jews who had a particular relationship of tax collectors to the Spanish government. And they were being forced to convert to Catholicism. And of course, a lot of Jews pretended to do that, but they didn't really. And so this Inquisition was to either force them out or force them to be fully practicing Christians. And also, this was the year that Queen Isabella and Ferdinand raised an army that defeated the Moors and pushed them out of Spain into North Africa and stole all of their lands, their wealth, their universities, their palaces, everything else. So it was an incredible consolidation of wealth. And the chairman talks about the fact that capitalism was born as the white nation. The white nation was consolidated through this process of assaulting. Oh, just to say, the fourth thing in that was that Queen Isabella also built and enlarged the slave trade, the trade in African people. So she had four fronts of attacking what we would say non-white people, you know, Africans and Jews, who many of whom were Sephardic Jews, who were Africans, mm-hmm. and, you know, and the indigenous peoples. And this is what brought incredible amount of wealth into Spain and consolidated it as a white and Christian nation. So I just think that that's really important, because
yes.
Here is this link between Sinterklaas or Santa Claus and Christmas in Holland that directly connects to Spain from the Middle Ages, which, by the way, in the Middle Ages did dominate or have control over parts of Holland. And the Dutch fought against Spain and kicked them out at a certain point, and then went on to build their trade in African people. And again, going back to their golden age, prior to that, Spain controlled the African trade. And so it's just really interesting that there's this connection between Sinterklaas and the Catholic Church, Santa Claus, Saint Nicholas, who was the patron saint of children and and who actually had been a bishop in Turkey in the 4th century AD, but, you know, was much loved, I guess, because he represented this kind of stand of going around the world and plundering, etc. So there's this connection from Sinterklaas, who comes to Holland on December 5th, which is his birthday, I guess, and he comes in a boat, and he brings with him the Zwarte Piets, which are the Africans, that, you know, in reality, white people dressed in blackface, but represent Africans from Spain in the Middle Ages, which were not, you know, and they're seen, they're portrayed as very evil characters, because the Zwarte Piet is the one that watches out to see if the white children were naughty or nice. And if they were good, they get the presents. And if they were evil, they get put in a sack and taken back to Spain, according to the legend. So, you know, as we see in this interview that we're going to play in a couple of minutes, we can see that little children are afraid of Africans. It makes them the evil characters, and Africans in Holland are pointed out as Zwarte Piet, especially during this time, in the holiday time. So, you know, I think it's just a really, really interesting thing that points out how this whole, every holiday, everything that we celebrate as a holiday or as a tradition goes back to the question of slavery, of genocide, of colonialism. It's capitalism's way of celebrating the goods and loot that has been stolen by at the expense of so many millions of people around the world, and which the majority of the planet still lives on less than $10 a day, with half the world living on less than $2.50 a day. So that same relationship is still there. And white people can use Thanksgiving and Christmas and other kinds of holidays to celebrate the fact that we sit on the pedestal of the oppression of everybody else. And aren't we happy and aren't we wonderful for that? And we thank God and everybody else for making us the good ones and everybody else evil. So I think it's a really, really profound thing and very telling about the conditions and the whole mentality of the white world, something that is being shaken from imperialism that's happening right now. And that crisis is brought about by the fact that Africans, Arabs, and indigenous peoples, and Asian people all over the world are rising up against this white power and taking back their resources, taking back control over their lives. And this is happening in so many different ways. We see it in the whole spring movement, the Arab Spring, and the other kinds of demonstrations and profound upheavals that are going on inside the Middle East right now and have been going on for the past year or so. But we also see it in the fact that millions of Africans, literally Africans and Arab people, are streaming into Europe, former colonial subjects, basically, as the chairman says, following their stolen loot so that they can have resources just to live, because everything has been stolen in their countries, and the people live in deep poverty. So that you see the demographic makeup of a country like Holland rapidly changing. In fact, white people, I saw an article not too long ago that white people are leaving Holland, right, going to places like Australia, New Zealand, that kind of thing, as Holland, as one example, becomes more and more and more African and Arab in its composition. So this is the reality. You know, this is what the whole issue of Christmas is summing up.
Yes. And you know, we, as you said, we're going to hear a clip of Chairman Amalia Yeshitela with a guest from Holland, an African from Holland, really summing up and addressing, you know, what the atrocious celebrations are that continue here in the world today, you know, really against African people. We're going to hear that in just a few minutes. We're going to take a quick break for some announcements, and then we'll get back with the clip from Chairman Amalia Yeshitela. You're listening right now to Reparations in Action. This is the show of the African People's Solidarity Committee on UhuruRadio.com. If you have to step away from your computer, you can listen by phone by calling in the U.S. 425-905-1825 or toll free at 888-207-2248. If you're in the U.K., in London, you can listen by phone by calling 020-3051-7985. Or if you're in Azania or South Africa, in Cape Town, by calling 21-673-6887, or in Johannesburg, Azania, 11-287-2287. This show has been pre-recorded, so we will not be taking any calls or emails, but we will return live with a live Reparations in Action show on Sunday, January 1st. And during the holiday season here, you can get Uhuru Holiday Pies, which is a way during the holidays to support the programs of the Uhuru Movement through the African People's Education and Defense Fund, through the fundraising work of Uhuru Foods in St. Petersburg, Florida, or in Oakland, California. Check out uhurupies.org, and even if you're not in those areas, you can order pies and have them donated to people in need. In Oakland, California, pies are available December 17th through 24th, and you can also call 800-578-5157. Or in St. Petersburg, Florida, pies will be available for pickup on December 23rd or 24th. And you can call 727-498-5210. There will also be free gift wrapping at Akwaba Hall, which is the hall in the Uhuru House at 1245 18th Avenue South in St. Petersburg, Florida. It's going to be Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Through December 23rd, and you can make a donation. A suggested donation will support the African People's Education Defense Fund. For more info, email info@apedf.org or call 727-821-2437. And in Philadelphia, this coming Thursday, December 22nd, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Uhuru Furniture, 1220 Spruce Street in Center City, there will be an Uhuru Furniture open house in which you can meet the staff and volunteers of the Economic Development Institution of the African People's Education and Defense Fund in its 17th year here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and have some free refreshments and some great deals through the Give Back to the People sale at Uhuru Furniture. And of course, we're going to be talking at the end of this show about the 2012 African People's Solidarity Committee National Conference, which will be held from January 8th through 10th, 2012, at the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida. And there'll be more info up at apscuhuru.org if you go there. And at the end of the show, we'll be talking about how you can get involved and book your tickets and get registered today. And Penny, we're back from the break and really appreciate the overview you've given on, you know, the truth about Christmas and Thanksgiving and all these holidays that imperialism has to celebrate itself and generate even more buy-in to unity with a parasitic system that lives off the backs of African and oppressed peoples the world over. And we're going to be hearing this clip from Chairman Amalu Yeshitela. What is it that the chairman will be discussing? What will we hear?
Well, he's interviewing an African woman who actually has a radio show in Holland. And she is part of a growing movement of Africans in Holland against the Zwarte Piet. And just talking about her own experiences, she was born in Guyana, which is a former Dutch colony. Mm-hmm. And she says she moved to Holland when she was 6 years old. And how she and her brothers and sisters were tormented by other children as the Zwarte Piet during this time of the year. And, you know, it's just a really good discussion. And I would also say that I went on YouTube to, you know, sort of searched for Zwarte Piet, and a lot of videos come up, most of which are in the Dutch language, so I couldn't totally understand it. I can understand it a little bit, but not totally. But, you know, you just might want to look at it, because there's a lot of stuff, including videos by white people in Holland trying to justify that this is not racist, this is not, these are not supposed to, and in fact, they even make up the thing that the reason that they're in blackface is because actually they went down the chimney and they're supposed to have soot on their faces.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. And doesn't even follow their own tradition, which they say they're supposed to be Moors, and Moors are Africans. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a really good clip. It's a really good interview. And, I think it just shows... It sheds light on the reality for Africans in Holland and the basis of, there's all kinds of, actually, there's other videos on YouTube of just hideous anti-African things that were on Dutch TV, not even Zwarte Piet, just all kinds of other things that have been on TV that are statements that people make. I mean, it's, you know, it's the last gasp of white power built on the slave trade, built on the assault on Africa in Holland, and trying to, you know, save their position at the expense of Africans and oppressed people around the world. But that day is over, as we know. Mm-hmm. So let's hear this interview.
All right, this is Chairman Amalu Yeshitela. A presentation from 2004 on uhururadio.com. You're listening to Reparations in Action. Uhuru.
Right now, people are in holiday mode in this country, and we've just experienced the Thanksgiving celebration of the genocide against the indigenous population, where everybody cheerfully stuffed themselves to the gills, those who could, ate a lot of turkey, and did a lot of other things. But thanks to Thanksgiving, the indigenous people have been almost entirely wiped out, and others of them stuck in concentration camps that we now know as reservations. And so everyone can be thankful that we can have mortgage payments and other things on property that rightfully belongs to the indigenous people here. But the truth is that virtually every celebration done in this country and throughout Europe, certainly since the 15th, 16th century, have been celebrations of slavery and genocide. And right now we're approaching the Christmas holiday. And the reality is that there are no innocent holidays. We, particularly African people, go about thankful that we've got a day off, and there's an excuse not to go to work, and there's an excuse for families to get together and do a lot of fun things. But just like Thanksgiving, Christmas itself has its origin in something that's not necessarily good for Africans and other oppressed people. And when I say Christmas, what I'm really talking about is not so much as the mythology that's associated with the Son of God being born, as much as Christmas as generally celebrated, having to do with gift giving and sharing and the emergence of this fantastic character known as Santa Claus. The gift giving, sharing expression of Christmas is really a response to efforts by 19th century European intellectuals to create a kinder, gentler capitalism. This capitalism, which was born of rape and slavery and colonialism of the world, but a capitalism which freed whites or the Europeans from feudal serfdom and creating the modern working class, white working class. We had people like Charles Dickens, who was a part of this campaign. And Dickens, of course, wrote the Christmas Carols, which was part of a campaign to make capitalism more humane for white workers, many of whom were children and women, men as well, who often were maimed by machineries and things like this, and worked without any kind of pity from the bosses who Ebenezer Scrooge came to symbolize in Dickens' book. In this country, the Santa Claus was born of the Dutch Sinterklaas. Sinterklaas was the patron saint of shipping in Holland. And as you know, the first captive African captives to come to this country were brought by the Dutch. And I would imagine the good ship Jesus, upon which we were brought here, was probably blessed by Santa Claus. You could say that we were a gift from Santa to America. And I was recently in Holland. In fact, just a few days ago, I was in Amsterdam and had an opportunity to experience a Christmas parade. And the difference in Santa Claus there and Santa Claus here is that while in the U.S. the myth is that Santa Claus brings bad children coal, stick coal in their stockings instead of gifts, and the bad children do not get gifts. In Holland, Santa Claus travels with a servant whose name is Vater Piet, or Black Piet. And Black Piet is the guy who, if the children are bad, he sticks them in sacks and takes them off screaming and fighting and kicking to Spain. And I happened to be, as I said, in Amsterdam a few days ago, where the Santa parade happened, and it was incredible. It was more than most Africans here could even imagine. But there's this situation where you have all these white people who have blackface. They wear blackface. They're like minstrels, like Al Jolson, and they are portraying Vater Piet. And they wear clothes that are similar to what Moors might have worn who occupied Spain up until the 15th century. And sometimes dancing and prancing in the streets. And sometimes they even wore fake dreadlocks. It was incredible to be an African standing there watching these minstrels, these white people in blackface marching down. And then, of course, you had this white man riding on a big white horse with a big cross on a hat that looked something like what the Pope might wear. And he was the beneficent Santa Claus. And Blackfeet Vater Piet was his servant. And so I got into a sort of impromptu debate with this woman who is called the mayor of Central Amsterdam, who was trying to explain to me why it was all right for these white people to be wearing this blackface, and why there was nothing wrong, but just as someone coming from the outside, I might mistakenly think that there was something bad about it. But the truth of the matter is that in Holland, African people also, many of them, find something terribly wrong with this Santa Claus Vater Piet combination. And a campaign has emerged where the Africans are struggling with the government of the Netherlands to do away with Vater Piet. And I have on the line with me from Amsterdam, Peggy Burke, who is also come to be a dear friend, who I met a few days ago in Holland. And I would like for her to join us in this discussion, because the truth is that when we live these isolated lives as African people in America or in other places, we come to think that our experiences are as Africans are peculiar to us. We don't understand that there's a universal oppression and ridicule of African people that has that have come as a consequence of our being a captive people, our land and resources stolen from us. So we're going to ask Peggy to join us and to talk to us about the campaign, about Swarta Piet himself, and how that's experienced by African people there, and what we need to be doing collectively to get rid of Swarta Piet and some of the other oppression that we're faced. Peggy, Sister Peggy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Omari. Uhuru to all the listeners as well. I feel very honored to be on your program. Well, I had you on my program a couple of weeks ago.
Indeed.
And it was very nice talking to you and sharing our views, and especially to see that the struggle for black people all over the world remains the same, and that we still haven't come very, very far in our struggle, even though sometimes we think we do, especially when you see a feast like Swarte Piet and Sinterklaas here in the Netherlands. It shows you how the racial conditions are for black people.
Yes. I was, I've in presentations that I've done for years now, I've talked about Swarte Piet and Sinterklaas in explaining the whole history of this phenomenon with Santa Claus here in this country. But I was shocked to actually to see this phenomenon when I was in Amsterdam. And the first thing I saw earlier that day at the train station, because I came to Amsterdam from Eindhoven. And was a child in one of the stores in the station who had on some kind of costume and what looked like soot on her face, and I thought perhaps it has something to do with Halloween or some kind of Halloween thing, and didn't pay that much attention to it until I got to this parade. That was shocking. I also noticed that there were Africans who came out with their families and their children to enjoy Santa Claus and Swarte Piet. So how is this thing being experienced?
Well, you see, people think about it very differently. And as you know, probably more than a lot of other people, is that one of the great things that colonization has done after slavery is that it taught black people that they are worth less than white people. So they started to believe it. And what happened is that they imposed this feast upon us, and even in countries like Suriname, where I come from, which used to be a Dutch colony, and in the Dutch Antilles, we were forced to celebrate this feast. And like many other things where white supremacy is posed upon us, this feast was accepted by black people. But when black people move from their country and they go to the country of the colonizer, they start to realize that everything they've learned in their country about the supremacy, it doesn't work, because you have white people fixing the streets, you have white people begging for money. So you see that, listen, all these things you've been teaching us, they're not true. So what happened is that there's a large movement here who says, we are no longer accepting this feast. But of course, there are still black people amongst us who don't see the harm of this caricature called Swarte Piet, and they just celebrate the feast with the Dutch like nothing has happened. So all we could have done in the last couple of years was make our people aware by doing radio programs, by writing articles in the newspaper about the wrongness of this feast. Well, we still don't have the whole group behind us, but I think we find more and more people learning to accept that this feast is against black people. It really puts black people down. I mean, if you listen to the songs that they're singing also during this feast, one sentence in a song is, "Even though I'm black as the night, I still mean it right." And the Zwarte Piet, the Black Piet, is portrayed as a black man. It's all white men walking there, but they put black paint on their faces and they're dressed exactly as how the Moors were portrayed. And then they walk around with this sack and with something to hit children with, like a sort of stick to hit children with who have been bad throughout the year. And this white Santa is sitting on his horse.
White horse.
And on his white horse, dressed as the Pope, you righteously said so. And then the Black Peeps, they have to do all the dirty work, and they act like clowns, and they make them speak Dutch on the television, for example, with a sort of Surinamese type of accent and pronouncing the words completely wrong, like they're speaking a sort of pidgin Dutch, and it's horrible. It's really horrible. And I mean, I'm telling people, listen, the only way we can change this is if we all keep our children, because in the schools, this feast is part of the school curriculum. So the children, whether they like it or not, they have to be part of this feast. So what I'm trying to ask parents to do is to let their children stay home on that day, so they don't have to be subjected to this type of discrimination, racism sort of element in the Dutch society.
Tell us about the feast. What does this feast consist of?
Well, what happens is that somewhere in November, like the middle of November, Santa Claus comes from Spain, they say, with his Black Pete. And in Spain, he has been monitoring how well the children have behaved themselves during the last year. And the children who have behaved themselves well, properly, will get presents, and the children who have behaved badly will be put in the sack, and they will be taken back to Spain with Sinterklaas. This is all fake, but this is the story. Now, what happens is that all the shops are decorated with this white Santa and his Black Pete. They are walking around throughout the city, and people are buying presents, and then they write poems for each other, like, poems in which they describe how people have behaved during the year, and then they exchange gifts. So it's like a lottery, and then you draw a name of somebody, and then, you know, like people do at Christmas time. And then you buy the person who you draw, you buy the person a present and write a little poem for that person. Well, what happens is that on the 4th of December, because it's Santa Claus' birthday on the 5th, and that's when he gives all the presents. He gives them on the 4th already. They call it Pakjesavond, which means packet evening. And then there will be a knock on the door, and there will be Zwarte Piet standing in front of the house with a whole bag full of presents for the children who live in that house. And, I mean, at a certain age, children do realize that the presents come from their parents and not from this Sinterklaas. But I know children who are very afraid of this Zwarte Piet element, because they're afraid that they will be put in the sack and taken back to Spain. And this is the, you know, the tenure of the feast.
I've read and heard that certainly a few years ago, little Dutch children would run screaming when they would see an African because of the Zwarte Piet connection.
Oh, I tell you, I feel very strongly about this, because I was 6 years old when I came to live in the Netherlands, and we were one of the three black families in a whole area in a city, because in the 1960s there weren't that many black people living here as they're living now. So from the minute Sinterklaas entered the city, he comes with a ship. Me and my brother and my sisters were called Zwarte Piet.
Mm.
And people were afraid of black, children were indeed afraid of black people, because in all black people, they would see Zwarte Piet.
Mm.
I mean, nowadays it's sort of different, but still children are being pestered. You know, children can be very rude towards each other. And they can they are pestered during this time, because if you're black, you are for these 2 months you're Zwarte Piet.
Uhuru, you are listening to Reparations in Action, the show of the African People Solidarity Committee on UhuruRadio.com. You just heard an excellent interview conducted by Chairman Amalia Shetela.
I thought that was a really interesting interview, and I think one of the things that it shows us is that there really isn't any part of our lives that is neutral or innocent. Everything around us, everything that we do in our, quote, culture or our traditions to shore up and save the system. They're connected to the roots of the system that is just built on the most hideous assault on African and other peoples here and around the world. And that's something that, you know, we have to be really clear about, because this system is deeply, it's evil, it's vicious, it's built at the expense of everybody else, and it's at the end of its, you know, of its time, because people are rising up because of this reality. And I just think it's important for us to really begin to look at everything that we take for granted and challenge it, and begin to really try to see the world as Africans experience it, Indigenous people experience it, Arab people experience it. And that if we begin to do that, we see that we're at a time of tremendous opportunity on the planet. Because the system built power, it can't survive. It just can't. White people are a tiny minority of the world's population. But if we unite with the struggles of oppressed people and formerly colonized people around the world, this is a kind of exuberance and the ability to really world. To make it be a place that all human beings can live in and can live with each other in peace. Mm-hmm. So it's in our interest to support this and to, you know, really, really start to look at everything we do and try to see it through the eyes of the majority of humanity. I think it's a tremendous opportunity. And if anybody listening would like to find out more about what we're talking about and find out more about the opportunity to see the world as Africans experience it, are welcome to come to the APSC National Conference, which will be January 8th, 9th, and 10th in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be an incredible, incredible conference this year. You know, we really encourage everyone to go on right now at apscuhuru.org, and you can register online. It's $100 for 3 days, which includes all of your food if you're from out of town. And you know, the travel there is you can find some deals, and housing is worked out. Everything you need to know is on their website right now at apscuhuru.org. And just to come down to see the Uhuru House, the embassy to the African world, to be in the Akwaba Hall is just a real experience. And then from the discussion that we had today, it is beautiful. And just the work that's gone into it from the summer project in St. Petersburg has really transformed it. What we've been talking about today is actually going to be the topic of the presentation that's going to open up the conference, The Rise and Fall of the White Nation, African Liberation and the Future for Humanity. I mean, we heard about, you know, as Penny, what you were saying about the origins of the white nation in 1492, that's the rise. And what we're witnessing right now in history is the fall. We're living in the time of the fall of the white nation, which is really incredible. So we're going to have the opportunity –